CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 42, with Dr. Neto Rossatelli from Brazil. And thank you to our podcast sponsors, Hero Incorporated. Dr. Rossatelli is an amazing surgeon. You know, in the U.S. as a whole, we do about 4 million cataracts a year, split among about 10,000 ophthalmologists who do cataract surgery, so maybe about 400 cataracts per surgeon per year is pretty much the average. So if you divide that up, that's maybe 8-ish cataracts a year, 50 weeks a year, something in this nature, and that's pretty typical. Sometimes we have a busier OR day and we'll book a lot of cases. We'll book 30 cases in a day, and we think, gosh, I worked so hard, that was a tough day. But there are surgeons like Dr. Rossatelli who routinely do 100 cataracts in a day in one operating room in 8 hours. And you think, wait a minute, how is that even possible? He explains everything. He works in the public health system in Brazil, and he does so much good. Can you imagine in a year he'll do 20 or 25,000 cataract surgeries? The number of people he can help is incredible. He's also evolved his technique to become more efficient, less invasive, and provide great outcomes for his patients. So little things like making both incisions before putting viscoelastic. Another one of rotating the nucleus so many times so that you free up all the cortex so you don't have to use the IA probe. Or doing hydroimplantation of the IOL at the end of the case so there's no need for cohesive viscoelastic to fill the bag. So you save some steps here and still produce fantastic outcomes for his patients. He's an incredibly gifted surgeon. He has his own YouTube channel, which we're going to link below. But I think you'll really enjoy this. And just think, in his career, he will easily help hundreds of thousands of patients. And if he can do a 40-year career, which I bet you he will because he's so passionate, he loves this, he could conceivably do 1 million cataract surgeries himself. I know, completely mind-blowing. Check it out. Listen to this podcast. I promise you will love it. And he is such an incredible man. And he's such a sweetheart, too. If you ever meet him in person, the nicest guy. Gosh, I really enjoyed this podcast. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today we have a very special guest. We have Neto Rossatelli from Brazil. I'm a big fan of his. I subscribe to his YouTube channel. I'll put a link down below so you can check out his channel as well. He posts videos in 2D, two dimensions, but also 3D videos. Incredible learning. And probably the surgeon that I admire the most in terms of his surgical efficiency. Neto, welcome to our podcast.
Oh, thank you, my dear Ude. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you for inviting me to be here.
So how did you get started in ophthalmology? Did you were always interested in ophthalmology since you were young?
Oh, I think I got interested in ophthalmology when I was the fourth year in medical school, and I began following the department of ophthalmology in my school. And then right after finishing medical school, I started residency program. This was in 87 and 88. 1988, I finished my residency and then started practicing. So it's about 35 years I have in ophthalmology. Wow.
But a lot has changed, like the way you did surgery in 1988 versus even the year 2000, 2010, now 2023. You keep changing. What's changed so much? Tell me.
Oh, yes. At the time of my residency, we were doing extracapsular cataract surgery, and I had the opportunity to perform even intracapsular cataract surgery. Wow. Because we have many patients that were aphakic in one eye. But right after that, I started in about 92, 93, I started doing phaco surgery.
And with things were hard. Yeah. With a scleral tunnel, right?
Yeah. It's with scleral tunnel, it was like when phaco was getting like more common. But it was hard times because it was very difficult to learn. We had to learn by ourselves. So I bought a phaco machine and learned to do phaco by myself. And we didn't have all the opportunities you have now, like the internet, you can watch videos. So it was a whole new, different way of learning, and there were not many surgeons from which we could learn. So it took a lot of time to be comfortable with the technique. And But after that, I think things got easier. As we performed more and more surgeries, we got more comfortable with the technique and always want to improve.
Yeah, and you've kept improving. So when you first started doing phaco, you probably just bowled out the nucleus. Then you did divide and conquer. Then you learn chopping. It keeps evolving.
Yes, phaco is a surgery that has a high level of difficulty, and as we say, like a steep learning curve. But it keeps changing. Everything changes. The technology changes, and we've been through all this, things that the patient expects about the surgery. Initially, the patient only expected like a better vision, even with thick glasses, like at the time of the intracapsular cataract. And all this evolved, like now, patients expect to see well in any conditions without glasses for all distances. So the challenges that the surgeon faces now are much greater. You have to deliver, you have to perform a perfect surgery, and of course your technique must evolve to be able to provide that. That's the challenge that the surgeons have right now. You must not fail. You must do a perfect surgery every single time.
Yes, you must have, patients expect 100% success.
Exactly. So this is something that I think surgeons must keep up with that. And along all this time, let's say, I can say that I was never satisfied with my technique. I always wanted to improve. I think that's what makes a surgeon improves his or her technique. You must not be satisfied. You must want to do better always.
Yes. Yes, you must compete with yourself to do better and better.
And this is something that some surgeons find it difficult, because learning is uncomfortable. You're always you're not in your comfort zone. You're uncomfortable performing new techniques, learning new techniques. And in addition to that, you're performing this in a patient. So, despite the fact that you're learning something new, you're practicing something new, you must deliver a perfect surgery. This is very hard to do, and it's a challenge. So, I think that's why many surgeons, when they get comfortable and proficient with some technique, they stop there. They avoid evolving because they don't want to get out of this comfort zone. We know that they deliver a good surgery, and to make it better, you must get out of this comfort. And many surgeons don't like that. But I think this is essential for you to evolve. So?
Yes, so we keep evolving. Now, when I watch your surgeries, one thing that I'm just amazed at is how efficient you've become. So, for example, I'm still less efficient in terms of I'll make a paracentesis, then I'll put viscoelastic in the eye, then I'll make the main incision. But you can just make the two incisions simultaneously with the anterior chamber just full of aqueous. But it's not as easy as you make it look.
Oh, yes. Certainly what made me, pursue this efficiency is the fact that for more than 25 years, I've been performing high volume cataract surgery in the Brazilian public health system. So in order to be able to do a high volume of surgeries in a day, you must be efficient. So this is something that I'm always constantly, paying attention on how to perform the surgery in the best way, perfectly, and at the same time, in the in a little amount of time. Right. And the way to achieve that is not speeding, not. It's being efficient and making every single step perfect. So many things that I do in my surgeries would be necessary for someone who performs 5 or 10 surgeries in the morning. it wouldn't make sense. But for me, it makes because I'm usually performing like 100 surgeons per day. So I must be efficient in this way. That's why some things that I perform, I do in my surgeries, let's say, many surgeons don't understand the reason that I do. It makes sense for me because I must perform a lot of surgeries per day. That's why.
Yeah, in the Brazilian public health system, you have a seemingly endless supply of patients. Patients are never ending. And so, yeah, you become very efficient. Also, I should point out when you said, when your high volume is different than my high volume, for me, if I think an American surgeon does high volume, that's maybe 35, 40 cataracts in a day. But for you, it's 100 or more.
Oh, yes. It's we have let's say a huge backlog in Brazil. In Brazil, we perform around 700,000 to 800,000 surgeries per year. We should be performing 2 million per year. You have the backlog never ends. And in the same way as in most countries, the population, the people are getting older and older, and we're performing surgeries earlier and earlier. When I did residency, it was not common to do surgery in someone like with 65 or 70 years old. Now I think it's the most common age. So we perform surgeries earlier and the patients live longer. And this, of course, augments the number, gets the number of surgeries that needs to be done bigger. And in here we have a huge backlog because most patients in Brazil depend on the public health system because we are not, let's say, a rich country. So that's another fact that makes it like that.
Yeah, one of those steps that makes it so efficient as well is what I call the Rossatelli spin. You'll spin the nucleus, not just a little bit, but many, many revolutions in both directions, which amazingly frees up all of the cortex. So then you can just use the phaco probe, remove the nucleus, and it removes all the freed up cortex, and then you're ready for IOL implantation without having to do an IA probe and cortex removal. Then you do hydroimplantation, and then you're done.
Yes, that's something that I began to do, to perform in like 13 years ago when I was doing surgeries in a northern state of Brazil, Acre, which is in the Amazon region. And I was like thinking, I must be more efficient with my time. Yeah. And by recording the surgeries and reviewing them, it was obvious that the surgical step in which most time was spent was cortex removal and cortex management. And afterwards, when I had to, fill the anterior chamber and the capsular bag with visco OVD, and then put the lens and aspirate all this OVD. So I thought I must eliminate that, or at least get this time, do it in a faster way. And I noticed that sometimes when I rotated the nucleus a little more, some cortex would come out. And I say, let's see if I can free up all cortex by doing more rotations. And during a whole year, I paid attention, and in a very not schematic, I'm losing my word, but I did one rotation one whole afternoon, and the other day two rotations.
So you analyzed it. You said what works
every
best
day. I did it different to assess how many turns I should make so that all cortex was released, and between 5 to 10 rotations I would achieve that. Then I began to perform that like in every single surgery, and I noticed that I really, really made the surgery faster. And it was, this is something that, let's say, I didn't describe at the time, but I didn't see anyone doing that. But anyway, after that, I said, and how do I get rid of all this time lost using putting OVD inside the eye and then aspirating when I after I implanted the IOL? I started, I saw some surgeons, some video with some techniques using hydro implantation. That's not, it's not something that I invented. It was already being described. And I started doing that. So that's how I could make my surgery more efficient in terms of time. And it really, allows you to perform the surgery in a very short amount of time. And this, in addition to any many other, techniques or ways that I perform my surgeries, I could shorten the surgical time to a reasonable, amount of time that allows me to perform 100 surgeries without rushing. It's in a very efficient and calm way. There are many other aspects that allow me to perform that high volume of surgeries with quality, and maybe later I'll talk about them because this is very important for people.
So for the Rossatelli spin of the nucleus, 5 to 10 rotations. So should you do five clockwise and then 5 counterclockwise?
Yes.
What do you recommend a new surgeon try?
Oh yes, I think in beginning to do that, it's easier to perform that in a medium harder nucleus. In softer nuclei, it's more difficult. In softer nuclei, you would need an instrument with a larger area to be able to, drag the nucleus. Because if you use a small instrument like an Agahara chopper or even a Sinsky, it would cheese wire in the nucleus when you're doing rotations. But you may have noticed I have two different ways or different spin techniques. One is the first one I've been doing for a longer time, just rotating the nucleus by putting the instrument on top of it. And almost at the raxis, the capsular raxis edge, and making the rotations clockwise and then counterclockwise. This is the easier spin. It's not as efficient, as effective, as the other one. The other one I began to perform 3 years ago, and it involves putting a long, very long and blunt ended chopper right at the equator, and it mechanically detaches the cortex 180 degrees. And the other 180 degrees, it just turns the nucleus. This is the sweep and the spin. This is very effective, and with this variation of the spin technique, you only need 2 rotations to each side. It's the one that I perform, the most, more frequently, but it is a very difficult technique, and I wouldn't recommend, of course, for, beginner surgeons. I think beginner surgeons are safer doing the regular spin. And I think one of the advantages of the spin is you don't need any special instrument. If you can use your regular chopper, and if you can't, if you can't make it so many rotations, that's okay. That's okay. It doesn't interfere with your technique. So you can build up the skills to end up performing the spin completely and all the rotations. But even if you can't manage to do all the rotations, if something, if you're finding it difficult, you just stop and continue with your regular surgery. So it's a very friendly technique to learn.
So if you're a younger surgeon, try the Rossatelli spin, get about a moderate nuclear density, 3+ nuclear sclerosis.
Yeah.
Use your chopper or Sinsky hook just right inside of the capsular axis, and then try to do the spin 5 or more times each direction, clockwise and then counterclockwise. And even if you can't finish and you can't do any more, it's okay. You can still do your divide and conquer, stop and chop. You go back to your regular technique.
Yes, so and it's important for the surgeon to be aware of this is a very important aspect or detail of the technique. Of course, you're going through the your side part, your paracentesis. You must be conscious. You must be pay attention to the fulcrum. You must perform with the chopper in order not to induce radial forces in the nucleus. You must, because the spin is safer if you make perfect rotations. So the forces you are applying are tangential and distributed throughout all the zonules. If you, let's say, if you're not able to do that, if you induce radial forces, you will be, you may risk, you're posing risk to the zonule. So this is a very important detail of the technique. You must perform the rotations perfectly. It's not necessary to make them fast. This is the, this doesn't matter. You can do them very slowly and it will work.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing you mentioned, that when we were young, I made the same mistake 20, 30 years ago. I thought speed was better, go faster, and it's actually the opposite.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because I can, when we perform that many surgeries per day, we are very aware of the time we spent doing surgeries and at the pace that we do things. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing because you begin to notice that when you pay attention and perform the surgical steps in the best way or perfectly, that's when your surgery is fast. Because you don't waste time. Everything you do has a purpose and has a positive result. And then this is the way to shorten time, not rushing, because when you rush, you don't perform the surgical step perfectly. And sometimes this will give you some issues because FACO is a well-known saying, is a step-dependent surgery. Every single step depends on the perfect execution of the previous one. So you must be attentive to that. And when you begin to be proficient in making every single surgical step in the right way, perfectly, you will notice that your surgery is, let's say, in a very short period of time and is effective, is efficient, I mean, because you don't waste time. And the other way to make it, like say, a surgery faster is not wasting time between surgical steps. Of course, you must have everything ready at your table. You must not, let's say, you did the incisions, and then you look up for where your OVD syringe is and taking. It must be ready for you to use. So this, let's say, outside the eye time is the shortest possible. Every single time that you, let's say, use in your surgery should be performing something inside the eye, not like, say, stopping and looking for something at the table and trying to know where it is, something like that.
So, yeah, don't waste time outside the eye.
Yeah.
So that when you're inside the eye, you can be relaxed and just efficient, focused on safety and efficiency. Now, you must have a fantastic team, because we all know that you can be the world's best surgeon, but if you don't have a fantastic or a great team, you can't be that efficient.
Yes, this is completely true. And I always say, many people ask me, Neto, how can you perform such a high volume surgery with such quality? And there is a single answer, because I have a wonderful team. Most of them have been with me for more than 13, some between 10 to 14 years. They know everything. And they rotate positions in the OR, so everyone knows every single, let's say, sometimes when I'm in a city, for example, because I rotate some cities in Brazil, we have a schedule, let's say, with all the team positions, all the participants, my assistants' position. One is instrumenting me, one is taking care of the surgical table, the other one is at the FACO machine giving me and preparing the FACO hand piece. Some other ones are putting and let's say positioning the patient. When we go to the other seat, they rotate like in a, let's say a volleyball team or something like that. So everyone knows every single position, all the tasks. They can understand each other. This is most important. And I don't have to worry about anything else. I have many people performing or doing everything for me. I just have to worry about the surgery. This allows me to focus on the surgery, and then I can easily get in what we say the flow. You only see the surgery. And this is the way that we can perform the surgery in the best way. Your mind is completely focused on the surgery. This is essential for me. When I go, let's say I go abroad, and sometimes I'll be performing some live surgery. If I don't have anyone, I usually have my wife. My wife is my chief nurse, and I have the luck to have her everywhere I go. So we travel together, and when I go abroad, she's with me. If she's with me, I can be like in Morocco doing live surgery. I'm okay because I know she will take care of everything for me. So this is most important. If I'm going to perform some surgery and I don't have my team or anyone, I'm sure my performance will be worse than what I could do, because I have to worry about everything else. So this is one advice that I would give to surgeons. I have many friends that don't have a team. They operate alone or with a surgeon colleague instrumenting and making the let's say, taking care of for him of the things. And this is wrong, because we surgeons are lousy helpers. We are good surgeons, but we don't know how to assist well, usually, because that's not what we do every day. And this is most important. Build an efficient and effective team so that you can relax and do your surgery the best way possible. We completely depend on them. And I'm sure you have wonderful assistance in your practice. Yeah.
Right. You said something very important, which is for you to be in that mental state of flow, you have to focus on just that surgery and nothing else outside in the room. Anything else in the operating room or operating theater, your team does it for you. So you can just focus. And that leads to that state of flow. And that leads to beautiful surgery, very low complication rate, high degree of safety, and very efficient.
Yes, this is the way to achieve the best performance for you. You must be able to focus your attention and at the same time be relaxed. And it's the same when you have some complications. You must be relaxed, and then that's the time that it's when you have some complications. Time doesn't matter now. You must slow down, think. What do I have to do step by step? Don't worry about, how am I going to fix this IOL? No, you must first fix what's wrong. And this is the time that you must perform things very effectively and in a calm way, let's say. You must not despair. You know what to do. We surgeons know how to do. And so by doing it in a very deliberate way, step by step, you will be able to finish the surgery in the best way possible and provide the patient with an excellent outcome. That's the way to face complications. You must not be, let's say, in panic, nothing like that. You must continue. So this is important. And I know, of course, for beginner surgeons, this is hard to achieve, but that's the way you should think. I think it's safe to say that it's for a surgeon, character skills are more important, usually, than technical skills, let's say, because you must be resilient to face adversities. You must be curious to want to learn new techniques. There are a lot of character skills that you must possess to be a good surgeon.
Right.
This is most important, of course. And I really say, we sometimes say, oh, this guy was born to perform surgery. He has a born talent to. I think this is this, let's say, it's just a small amount of what right. we have when you have a good surgeon. The biggest amount that allows a surgeon to be, let's say, an outstanding surgeon are learned skills. He worked or she worked hard to achieve that. That's what right. Thomas Edison used to say. A genius is 99% perspiration, only 1% inspiration.
Yeah.
So that's our day to day. We work hard to learn new techniques, to be able to perform this perfectly. It's not something that comes to us like naturally. No, it's training. It's training, training, and training.
Yes, absolutely. It's mostly hard work. Like yeah. I would tell the residents when I used to be a professor for 22 years, I said, no one is born knowing how to suture with 10-0 nylon.
Yeah.
But if you can do work in the wet lab every night and become better suturing, and if you can do, my rule was, if you can do 10 sutures of 10-0 nylon in 10 minutes on a tomato, you don't have to have a patient.
Yeah.
If you can do this, now you've trained yourself. But yeah, it's all hard work. It's 99% perspiration. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, and of course, we must love what we do, because it's hard work. It's long hours. We have many responsibilities. We have, let's say, sometimes our work is, we have a tremendous amount of pressure to deliver, to make a good surgery for the patient. This is difficult to handle, but when you love what you do, this is not work. As when you love what you do, you don't work. It's like let's say, I don't know if I can convey that, not vacation, but you when you're doing what you love, you do without almost without effort. You don't
it's
feel that
it's your passion, so, for sure.
This is of course, essential for a surgeon. He or she must love surgery and be able to feel happy when you say, oh, this surgery was amazing. Now, look what I achieved. To be able to be content, to be satisfied in what you did, to be proud of it. This is most important. So that's what keeps us going.
It's all the passion. I mean, it's why we do all these things, why we're doing a podcast. We love talking about surgery because we love surgery. So for you to do so many surgeries, how does your team manage the pre-op and the IOL calculations, and then who sees the post-op patients? How do you manage all this?
Yes, I usually don't see my patients beforehand, and I have a team of, let's say, colleagues that screen, do the patient screening. It's a very complex thing, I think, for me to explain how we work here in the public health system, because you have patients referred to us to be operated. Some come already with an ophthalmological evaluation. Some came just like old patients with poor vision. So we must do everything. And in many places that I operate, in many cities, patients come from far away. So we must be able to do all this on the same day. Patients come, are screened, and they are examined, and they then surgery is indicated for them. And then they perform all the ophthalmological evaluation, biometry, and everything else. And then they're prepared. They are operated on. They receive the post-op orientation, and they go back. This is how it usually works in most cities that I work. So I have a big team that makes all these evaluations, the examination. So when the patient comes in, it's usually the first time that I see the patient. I of course have all the details of the ophthalmological examination and the history of the patient, the characteristics, but this is done by a whole team, and usually everything on the same day. It's a very different thing. Like, yes. I had my private practice here in my city in Ribeirão Preto, which is in the state of São Paulo, for 28 years. And it was completely different, like yours. I would see the patients, and then on a following up visit, he or she would do all the examinations. We would schedule the surgery. But it's completely different in the way I work.
Sure.
So, of course, everything has to be adapted, and it must be efficient, because you must have, let's say, a patient flow from beginning to end to be able to do that. And then we say every single person that works in this chain has the same importance.
Of course.
The ones that receive the patients and make history, they examine the ones that take the patient up to operating room, simple tasks, but they are all in the same level of importance, because everything must work.
Right.
So it's not easy, but it's very satisfying to see that very limited resources in the public health system, we are able to do such a wonderful work with such quality. So we say it's possible. It's possible with great effort, of course, but it's possible to do it. So this is something that really makes me proud. And that's why I left my private practice. My private practice was completely the opposite. I have a very high-end practice here in my clinic. All, let's say, top dollar paying patients, everything. But I didn't like it. I didn't like it. It wasn't challenging for me.
Yeah.
I loved performing surgeries on the public health system. And of course, these two very different practices weren't compatible to be performed at the same. I was used it to be 20, 25 days away doing surgeries in the public health system, and then return to my private clinic and have only 4 days, 5 days to see my patients. I couldn't, of course, keep this practice with quality, staying so little in. So I had to choose. And I think it was the one of the best things that I did. It's that, because of course, it was not the, let's say, the smartest one in terms of money. No, but it gives me so much pleasure to be able to perform that and see the very high volume of surgery that I'm able to do per year. I usually like 18 to 20,000 surgeries per year I do.
Wow.
With such quality, yeah. It's something that I'm really proud of, because I feel that I'm able to deliver the most of my practice, of what I learned, of what I'm able to do. That's what I feel about that. So it's something that gives much satisfaction for me.
I mean, that's incredible to do 18 or 20,000 surgeries in a year. You help so many patients. It's unbelievable. How many cities do you travel to? So you travel all over then in Brazil?
No. I usually stay in the state of São Paulo and Santa Catarina. Santa Catarina is a small state in the southern region of Brazil. I usually perform surgery in a very, let's say, nowadays for 4 to 5 years, I've been performing surgeries like almost always in the same cities in a regular interval of 1 to 2 months. So it's the same cities. We have structures, let's say, we have clinics, or we have regular practice in this city. So we are always returning. We have doctors there that perform the examinations, follow the patients. This is the best way to do. So it's about 10 to 12 cities right now.
Do you ever do for some of these patients bilateral same-day surgery?
Yes. I can say that about 50 to 60% of my surgeries are simultaneous bilateral surgeries.
Wow, fantastic. So you do one eye and then immediately do the second eye, new gown, new gloves, new everything?
Yes. As if it were another patient, but it's, let's say, in a sequential way. This makes sense in the public health system. Not for the surgeon, it makes no difference. But for the patients and for the health providers, and by the health providers, I say like the health secretaries and the public health institutions that take the patients to be operated on, this is a huge issue because patients going, they only go a single time and have both eyes operated on, and so this saves a lot of money for them because they have to provide the patients transportation, the people that accompany, that escort the patients, usually some family member, they only need to go one time. So this is something that for us, it makes no difference. Of course, in a hospital, it makes a big difference because if I'm doing, like, say, 100 surgeries and half of them will be bilateral, we have a much smaller number of patients there. And when you do 100 surgeries per day in a hospital, it's a huge number of people inside the hospital. So you have many issues about that. Where do these patients will stay and everything else? So this makes sense in this way and in many other ways. So in a regular practice, let's say in a private practice, this doesn't make much sense. But it has been proven that it's as safe as in terms of endophthalmitis and other complications doing one eye and two eyes. I think as we perform more and more like clear lens extraction with refractive purposes, especially presbyopia patients, this will become more common because patients, when we use like multifocals IOLs, there is this interval between one surgery, one eye and the other, it's difficult for the patient and also for the doctor because they are not seeing well yet. And you are under pressure to perform the other surgery in a shorter time. There are many countries that perform, it's a regular thing to perform bilateral surgery, cataract surgery. I think Norway is one of them. I have a friend there that reports his huge experience in that. This is a routine for them. Bilateral cataract surgery or bilateral, refractive lens surgery in most of the patients. So that's, for me, it's about 50 to 60% of cases.
Most of your patients are probably getting monofocal IOLs.
Yes, all of them, because in the public health system, we are it doesn't contemplate multifocals or any other, let's say, premium IOLs, and we are not allowed to offer that. And even if patients would be able to bring the IOL, then we can't use it. This is to avoid issues like doctors charging patients for a different IOL and so. So if the patient is getting, is being operated on the public health system, he or she will get a monofocal IOL. So we usually perform some, small monovision or...
So like
give
Plano
them
and minus one?
Only slightly myopic, like minus 3.50, minus one on the other eye. That's usually what we do with these patients. Of course, this varies a lot according to the patient, but most of our patients are not that active, so we have a great leeway on what we need to provide in terms of refractive outcome. So this makes our life very easy.
Yeah, I think having one eye minus 0.5, the other eye about minus one, that's such a mild degree of anisometropia. It's very easy to tolerate. And a little bit of myopia, day-to-day tasks like cooking food or cleaning your house is much better than being plano in both eyes.
Yeah, that's what we did before multifocal IOLs were available. We did usually like that, varying a little, of course. There are many schemes of combining some refractive outcome, but I think this is a good example of what works for, like, say, most patients. So in this aspect, I can say that I still live we did 20 years ago, with no worries about all these issues that we have with premium IOLs today, some side effects because of the optical characteristics of the IOL, something like
sure,
that.
Sure.
And patients are very happy, and they know they will need. We advise them. We say that you will need glasses. Many of them don't need any. No, doctor, I'm okay. I don't need it. So that's what was our day-to-day life like 20 years ago when we didn't have multifocals. And patients are very happy about that. So it brings us tranquility about astigmatism, residual astigmatism for the patient. Of course, we try to, enhance our results by operating on the steepest axis of steepest meridian, corner meridian of the patient has. But this is not so important as, of course, compared to when we are going to put a premium IOL on the patient's eye.
No, for sure. It makes a lot of sense there.
Yeah.
So for your patients post-op, are you putting intracameral or subtenon injections of antibiotic, steroid, or are they just using eye drops?
No, only intracameral and antibiotic. I use moxifloxacin, intracameral moxifloxacin, and that's all. I don't use usually some corticosteroid intracameral or nothing. Sometimes outside the eye in very selected cases like post-uveitis and something like that, we use some corticosteroid injection outside. In a few cases I use TA, triamcinolone in intracameral, but it's not usual. So our routine is intracameral and then eye drops with antibiotic and anti-inflammatories of the both kinds.
So with your system, you sometimes must get surprised with the patient tissue. You're seeing a patient for the very first time in the operating room, on the operating table, through the microscope, first time, and you sometimes must look in the eye and say, oh, wow, there's a decentered lens or some weak zonules, or you go to start at the rexus and the whole capsule wrinkles. You must get surprised, no?
Yeah, this is something that, especially zonular problems are sometimes difficult to perceive preoperative at the sleep lamp. Some things you only see when you are inside there. So yeah, this is something that you must be prepared to. So I have inside my operating room the whole grid of three-piece IOL, the whole from all available IOL powers. So if I need, I have the option to use them, and I must have everything else like pupil
CTR.
Expanders and capsular tension rings, everything I must have because I can't foresee. And you must imagine if we are seeing the patients on the examining, receiving, examining, and operating on the same day, I must carry a huge, we usually carry about 4,000 to 5,000 IOLs.
Oh, wow. Us.
Yes, we have to have the whole inventory because we don't know. And we get out and we are performing like 1,500 surgeries in that month. And we go like a circus. We have, let's say, our people, the truck that carries all the equipment. We carry everything.
I didn't realize.
Yes, and not only one, too, because I must carry two phaco machines, microscope, everything else. Because if we have some issue with some equipment, I must have backup. I can't send patient like a patient, 100 patients that came from 2 to 250 kilometers away back home because my equipment broke. I must have a backup of everything. So we carry all this. It's
like you said, like a circus.
It's a Herculean logistics.
So you're able to do 100 cases basically with one operating room and one phaco machine.
Yes. Yes.
So then you must do one surgery while behind you they set up the next?
No.
How do you do so many?
Up until COVID came, it was my routine was to use two surgical tables, like in almost a V configuration, and microscoping. So I would switch like that. I would be doing surgery here. The other patient was going. It was being prepared, but. When COVID came, we had to practice social distancing, and also that's when I started using the heads-up surgery, the Ingenuity system. Sure. And with the Ingenuity system, it's not practical to have two surgical tables, and I really didn't like that. I use it because it was more practical and allowed us to do a high number of surgery, but I hated it, in fact. And now I use only one table, and my assistants switch the patient in between them. And usually don't take long. So it's very tranquil for us to do 100 surgeries like that. So
they must switch out the patient. The turnover must be like 2 minutes or 1 minute.
Yes, I usually, let's say, my usual rhythm would be like 12 patients per hour. That's what we, that's
3 minutes of surgery, 2 minutes of prep.
Yeah, yes, exactly that. But it varies, of course, because some cases take longer than others. But it's not that common for me to have too many difficult cases in a day. And sometimes we are able to, make this difficult cases are identified beforehand, and then we have strategic timings during the surgeries that we put these patients. This is taken into account, and my wife is the one that chooses that, and she stays outside the room usually, choosing patients which are have a better dilation, are well prepared, and. So she makes the she chooses which one is going the order of them. Yes. And then when we have some more difficult cases, sometimes you have a lag, some bus that's coming from some city gets delayed, and then we know that at some point we will have a lull in the patients coming, we plan to perform these more difficult cases like that. Or sometimes you have some issue with the autoclave sterilization cycle, and then we say, there might be some shortage of instruments, sterile instruments, and so we put some longer surgeries that we don't stop. Yeah, there's a lot of
How many surgical trays do you have, or how many handpicked?
I work with 50
5-0.
Yeah, it is necessary because And this is a tip. You usually need, let's say, if you perform, we do the complete cycle, let's say a rapid cycle with drying time, everything by the book. Yeah. So if the autoclave cycle time is 1 hour, door to door, open, okay. Yeah, you close the door and you open the door, door to door, 1 hour. You need to see how many surgeries you perform in that time. So in 1 hour, I usually perform 12 surgeries. Usually, you will need three times the number of surgical trays that you perform during one autoclave cycle. So I would need to, let's say, to run 12 surgeries a day without any issue with one autoclave, I would need 36 surgical trays. This is very consistent. And so, I need many instrument trays. And of course, there are issues. Sometimes let's say we have some power outage at the hospital and the cycle fails and then you must start. So you have to have
backup.
So that you don't stop. Yeah.
Wow, such
Yeah.
I must come visit you one day just to see this whole. It's like a ballet. Everything is just like a perfect dance in unison, all together.
Yeah, that's something that surprises me. You'll be very. I'm looking forward to have you and I will surely learn much from because I know that you give so. So many good advice for me because right. When we visit each other, you can see things that we usually don't. And you are such an expert, Sergio. I'm looking forward to receive you. And of course, you are invited. It will be a wonderful to have you. But you know, there are many things that many surgeons don't imagine that. Goals when we perform high volume surgery, and most of them are very surprised because the room itself it's very quiet, it's very calm. We have calm music for the patient. And say, Neto, I wouldn't say that you would do, let's say, the all day pass it, and there were 100 surgeries. It's a very relaxed ambient. And when I finish, of course, you have some. Physical, let's say, I'm tired, but tired in a good way because we saw a day pass, we saw many different cases, and everything went well. And this is because my team is wonderful. So they are, and many colleagues that are there are Neto. So I'm the thing that amazed me the most is they know. Exactly what you need, even in different, like say in a complicated surgery, you don't have to ask for anything because they look and they know, and they really they are very knowledgeable about every kind of different surgery I do. So they know exactly if I'm doing some IOL fixation, I don't have to ask. Oh no, give me my micro scissor, my micro forceps. I'll need
they already
some,
know. They know.
No, it's all there. I don't need to ask anything. If so, they see some pupil prolapsing. I don't even need to ask. The myocall will be there, and so this is very easy on my mind. And I usually say because when I operate, I don't look at the table. I look at the screen and go like that, taking the instrument. I say, take care. Be careful because. Anything you put in my hand, I'll use it in the eye. That's like that because I trust them completely, and so this makes my life much easier. Yeah.
But when you have team members who've been with you for so many years and so many thousands of surgeries, you're at the point where they can just read your mind. They can look at the monitor. They just give you what you need. You don't have to say a word.
Yes, they are like I say, they are my team, is my family. We travel together. We have a wonderful time together. It's a wonderful ambient of camaraderie.
Yeah.
Yes.
How many team members do you have? How many people
in the
team?
That travels with me inside the room, seven or eight. Yes. So, so we are, and they are very proud of what they do. You should see. When there is some different surgery or something like that, they are thrilled to be part of that because they know it's something special. So it's very a very good way to work. I could say I live a surgeon's dream because
yes.
I own surgeries. I have a wonderful team. I work the way I want with. I have wonderful equipment. So this is a dream come true for me.
And you can help directly hundreds of thousands of patients. Yes. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Sometimes when we get out at night to dine and we see many, many patients with the dark glasses because we advise them to use it even night so that they don't touch the eyes. So we see many, many patients. So we operated them. This is very, very sad.
Makes you feel good, of course. Now tell me, the last thing I want to talk about is tell me about your YouTube channel. I'm a big fan. I subscribe. Oh. I'm going to put a link here. So hopefully my cataract coach fans, please also subscribe to Neto's channel. Tell me about your YouTube product because you have a lot of great videos up.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yes, the YouTube channel, you know, it started, it has a curious history. The one that I started first was not the Neto Rosatelli one. It was the cataract surgery channel, in which it would be like a more formal channel with something like almost like classes and with voiceover. And then immediately after that, I got a very, very severe case of Bell's palsy and on my right side. And I was almost unable to speak, especially in English, because you have some phonemes in English that I like I couldn't say like that.
Right.
I can't speak on the channel. So I said, I'll make a separate channel. And then it struck the idea to make like a video clip of a cataract surgery. And I was, when I was in my teens, in the 70s, I was a DJ. We didn't say but at that time it was common to have big parties, disco. It was a disco era, and they had big parties. And I and two friends, we provided music, sound, light, everything for these parties. We are 14, 15 years old, but we are able to make a significant amount of money doing that, and we love that. And so I got very, is a skill. Like we use it like reel-to-reel tape recorders and vinyl
records, yeah,
you know, that kind of analog systems.
Right.
And I would like record 1 or 2 hours long tape and make all the mixings. And so I was very accustomed to that. So video editing came very easily for me.
Sure.
And I've been recording surgeries, of course, since the VHS tape recorders era. And I love doing that. And music for me is something very special. So when I choose a video, a surgery for the channel, it usually takes like half an hour to, let's say 1 hour for me to edit the video.
Right.
I usually take like sometimes 2 hours to choose the music and to add. Sometimes I have to edit the music and add the video. So this is something that most people don't notice, but sometimes the music tempo changes according to the surgical steps. So mm-hmm. I have to. Yes, and so when I have a video, a surgery, I say, I think this music will fit well in this. And it's amazing because sometimes I have some surgery and then I look and then I edit it and say, I don't know, I don't think I like it. And when you put music,
you like it.
It transforms it because it is a whole different experience. So I don't like to do voiceovers in that. I'm not being making many videos on the other channel where I use it to do voice. I don't like my voice. I think that's why. I think I speak like the Donald Duck.
No, you're perfectly fine.
So, but I really should get back to the other channel and do more voiceovers and everything else. But I wouldn't. I put some captions on the Facebook clips. Only because I'm, let's say, I need to, because if I don't put captions, the comments are, there are too many asking and many, so you don't understand what's being done. So the captions are, let's say, something that I hate the captions, but I need to put them to
explain. It's a lot. People don't realize to make one video, 1 5-minute video is a lot of work.
Yeah. In my experience, usually 10 times. The duration of the video. If you have a 5 to 6 minutes, you take 1 hour for you to edit everything. It varies, but usually like that. But I love doing that. I do it all by myself. I don't have any help. And usually the time that I do most of my video editing, surprisingly, is when I'm going from city to city in our van, because it takes some time, 12 hours. We have sometimes you travel 1,000 kilometers from one city.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's when it...
you have your laptop.
So that's when I do most of my video editing. But
right.
I'm amazed at how you can upload one video per day. Oh, I really amazed at that.
It's, as you know, it's 99% perspiration. It's just hard work.
Only let's say only YouTubers understand the Herculean effort it takes.
Yeah,
a lot of care and a lot of love doing these videos, because and it's a very satisfying when we go somewhere else and young surgeons come and say, "Oh, please, doctor, don't stop making the videos, because it my surgery. It helped so much. You much more than me must have this feedback." It's something that's very satisfying, and that's what keeps us going, because you see that you can help many, many people, and we didn't have that when we were in training.
Correct.
So this is a precious thing that we can offer for a beginning and a very experienced surgeon. And in my channel, I try to show every, let's say, different technique that is, even if I don't use it. When someone shows me a different technique he or she invented, I try to learn and to show in the channel. So.
No, it's fantastic. Well, I want to thank you for spending the last hour chatting with us. This is an amazing podcast. I definitely, again, encourage my viewers, my listeners, you definitely have to check out Neto's YouTube videos, beautiful surgeries. And then they're also in 2D and also 3D. So if you want to watch 3D videos, they're there. Lots of them.
So thank you, Yude. It was an immense pleasure to be here with you. And I must say, I admire your work and your channel in ways that it's amazing. So I congratulate you for all the effort in ophthalmological education. You were something like unique in our field. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I will see you again in person at the Brazilian Cataract Refractive Meeting coming up in May of 2024. I'll be there.
So, thank you.
I look forward to seeing you then. And thank you guys for listening to the podcast. I want to remind you, we have a new podcast every single week. You can watch it here on YouTube. You can see it on Cataract Coach. It's also available on all podcast services, Apple, Amazon, Google, Spotify, you name it. And I'll see you guys next week for another fantastic podcast.
Thank you for enjoying that podcast with me. I trust you really learned a lot and learned from that insight of Dr. Rosatelli of how we can all be more efficient, even if we're only doing a tiny fraction of what he's doing. I also want to thank our sponsors, Harrow Incorporated, for sponsoring our podcast. And we will see you next week for another great episode where we will all enjoy and learn together.